trying to get back to the basics of great products.
Power comes from sharing information.
I try to convince people to slow down.
Free. Yeah. Open.
This is the Soak Tyson Podcast.
Yo, listeners, welcome to the slush, the immediate cringe. Yo, hi, all listeners, this is the slush, Soaked by Slush podcast. My name is Isak Rautio. Next to me is sitting William von der Palen, actually. This is the mistake I did on the first season of Futukast, mispronounced your name. But now the von der doesn't even say von der on your name tag.
Slush forgot two-thirds of my name, as usual, but that's fine.
What happened?
I don't know. I think they ran out of ink or something when printing the passes, but, you know, it's fine. And we're back with yet another Soaked by Slush podcast episode. And this time we have yet again a really interesting guest, Victoria Turk from Wired. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great that you're here. Who are you? Do you want to give the, you know, long and short to the listeners?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm Victoria Turk. I'm features editor at Wired Magazine in the UK. So I look after all of our long form features in the print magazine and online. I've been at Wired for about 3 years. So I cover everything from technology to science, business, innovation, culture, everything that's exciting about the future.
What brought you here to Slush?
So I've been doing various things at Slush this year. I just got off stage where I was interviewing Claire Novarol from Ada Health, which is an AI health tech product, which was super interesting, talking about how to build a product that people trust with their lives and how to kind of earn that trust with an AI product. I was at Founder Day yesterday, running a workshop, and also interviewing Gustav Söderström from Spotify, who was talking about product management and how to develop a product in the age of AI and machine learning. So I've been very busy.
Yeah, sounds busy. Yeah, will you be as busy?
Yeah. Oh yeah, you know, I love Slush. This is my third time here.
Third time.
And yeah, I've met loads of people here. I've got lots of meetings lined up.
Yeah. We love talking to journalists because most journalists have very like different and varying stories that they need to write about or get to write about, and they see the world from an interesting angle. So what are some of your most recent articles or something you've been excited about lately?
Oh, wow. So my most recent long-form feature for Wired was actually quite an unusual topic. It was about microdosing psychedelics.
Yeah.
And the first scientific studies looking at that practice and whether it has some of the benefits that people in the microdosing community claims it has. That was a bit of a quirky one. I've got a long-form story coming up in the next issue of Wired, which is out in December. We're recording this in November. I don't know when people will be listening to it, which is all about, I can't be too specific, but it's all about technology in the world of art and very much bringing new imaging technology into the very old school world of fine arts. So I really love those stories that are like at the intersection of culture and technology.
What about the, I just heard this podcast about with this guy called Paul Stamets, I think, this sort of mycologist who basically talk about the same subject. What are some of the insights from this article that you were, your most recent one?
The microdosing
yeah.
one? Well, so it's I basically went to meet some researchers in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam, and in London as well, actually, who are running some of the first controlled studies with a placebo control to see what effect, if any, taking a small amount of, in this case, it was psilocybin truffles, can have on people's focus, on their sense of well-being, their psychological health. To be honest, at the moment, it's still very early days, and you know the results are kind of still being published, so we don't know for sure. And there's so many variables with this work. So it's one of those interesting things where there's a real subculture around this. But it's never really been scientifically studied that much, not kind of with a proper trial with a placebo control. And there's obviously lots of difficulties around that because of things like regulations and legality and things like that. So it didn't kind of bring any conclusive answers, but it was really interesting to see researchers sort of taking a scientific look at that.
Awesome.
I Googled you before this episode.
Oh,
and I
no.
saw
we did our homework.
No, yes.
What did you
something
find?
You never want to. No, I saw from Wired, actually. I saw this list of articles you've written, and one of them was deepfake.
Yes.
And how it's been already degrading democracy in a way. I didn't have time to read the article, sadly, but now you're here, so that's awesome.
I can explain it all to you then.
Please, yeah.
If listeners haven't heard of deepfakes, that's referring to basically faked videos,
yes.
Which use AI to usually put someone's face on another person's body or make it look like they're doing something or saying something that they haven't really. And a lot of people are concerned about this because they think of kind of a hypothetical situation where maybe you could have a video of a politician, a president, a prime minister saying something that they didn't actually say. So it's essentially like fake news. But we sort of trust video, I think, more than other media. So when you have that kind of blatant fake news in video, it's quite scary. There's this idea that it could undermine democracy. However, if you actually look at the deepfakes that are out there at the moment, I think it's 98% of them are not like that at all. They're porn. They're non-consensual pornography where real women's faces have been basically put on top of porn stars to make it look as if, you know, there's a video of them having sex. And this is like how this technology is actually being used right now. So in that article, I was basically arguing that use of deepfakes, which is much more prevalent right now than any other use, does undermine democracy, because there have been instances where we've seen an investigative journalist, for example, she was reporting stories in India, and then she found herself in one of these deepfakes, which was intended obviously to humiliate her and ultimately to silence her. And you know, it kind of worked. She ended up kind of closing her social media accounts, and she was sort of self-censoring because of all this harassment and abuse that she'd got through this deepfake technology. And we've seen similar issues happen with revenge porn, which is like this, like when people share intimate images of you without your consent. So I basically was sort of trying to emphasize the fact that this way that deepfakes are used to harass and abuse women actually is already a threat to democracy, and we don't have to wait for this technology to be used to fake a presidential or a prime ministerial address.
Yeah, like I'm 26 now, and I remember 5 years ago even, we were like, this was sci-fi. Like, you were thinking about this, like, when are we going to cross this uncanny valley? Like, it's somewhere in the future, and like, but when it happens, it's going to be a huge threat. Like, how are you going to be able, with your six senses? How many senses do we have? Five senses.
You have six, one, apparently. No, but yeah. We spoke also in Finland to the Supreme Court about this. And of course, we didn't realize at the time that they can't really say much about the thing because they will give...
They can't really set a precedent.
Yeah, they can't say it. But they emphasize the fact that, okay, I think this is a great and big problem that's gonna be... at least not in the courts a big problem, but they said that in the courts it's not enough with just a video, you need actual evidence as well, you need DNA, you need something like that. So I'm hoping it won't be, you know,
but isn't that the problem? Like the judgment of the masses is even more, like the consequences from that can be even more humiliating and harmful than even just like a court sentence.
Yeah, and you know, I guess so. That you're talking about, I guess, if this was used to fake a crime or something. Yeah, that's an interesting idea. I hadn't thought of it being used in that way. So we've had an artist recently in the UK made these deep fake videos of, we're currently in the midst of a general election, and so they made a deep fake video of our prime minister saying you should vote for the other candidate, and the opposition saying you should vote for the incumbent, and you know, this artist said that this was just to demonstrate how this technology could be used in the future. I'm not sure if it was a great idea. idea to make those videos anyway. It did say at the end of the videos that they were fake. So yeah, I mean, I think you're right. You know, it doesn't really matter. Yes, it might be possible to tell that they're fake, but it's the same thing with fake news that we see today. It spreads so quickly. You know, people believe what they want to believe, and it can be very difficult to stop that from proliferating really fast. It also can be quite difficult to come up with rules on how to moderate that content. You know, do you want to say that this content, like deep fake technology, shouldn't be used at all or shouldn't be able to put on social media? But then, you know, is that potentially preventing people from using it in creative ways or artistic projects and things like that? So yeah, it's comes back to the old thorny issue of content moderation and you know, the how we use technologies being the much bigger question than the technology itself.
I think that's a really good point and interesting take also on it. But I would argue that you can already do that. It's really easy already to shame someone completely on social media by just, you know, if someone has 10 million followers and the person you're shaming has 10 followers, you're just going to spread the rumor so much more efficiently. So you can do a great deal of damage already without any videos, just by writing a few words on Twitter.
Well, that's interesting as well, because with this deepfake discussion, you know, we've seen cases where people haven't needed deepfakes to convincingly spread fake news or even fake videos. There was a video of Nancy Pelosi in the US, a US politician, and it had been slowed down to make it seem as if she was slurring her words.
Yeah, drunk.
Like she was drunk, yeah. And it was really kind of basic video editing technology. And it was very easy to see that it wasn't real. And yet, you know, people still shared it and spread it and made fun of it. So yeah, there's definitely a question there. You know, you don't have to use the most sophisticated technology.
And it's bad because the people who draw the conclusions from those videos are the people who are already confirming their sort of prejudgments in a way. And like, people do that even, not, you don't even need a video. You just need a headline.
Yeah.
You can just post an article. You don't even open the article. And this is actually interesting because you worked for Wired. Like, how is Wired or even the media, like mainstream media in general, dealing with this type of sort of media? I guess atmosphere where the sort of competitive edge requires. I mean, I don't want to say requires, but like in a way, like you get competitive edge by taking these shortcuts.
Yeah, it's you know, I think trust in media has taken a hit for various reasons. At Wired and, you know, at sort of any sort of reputable publication, I'd hope, we're obviously very wary of not overpromising, not kind of using what you might call clickbait or anything like that. You know, I think it is on us as journalists to make sure we're representing stories accurately, and that's super important. Like, yes, you want people to read your story, but you can't sacrifice those kind of basic tenets of good journalism, which is that it has to be accurate and it has to give an accurate representation. And I think, you know, it is difficult to watch this trust in journalism erode, especially when it seems to be largely fueled by politicians. And I think that is very dangerous.
Because it seems, whenever I meet a journalist, it seems like journalists are the people who hold these values most dear and most close to them, and they actually see, they actually have journalistic integrity. But as you start to enter this game and you sort of get immersed in the rules of the game, you start to give up maybe a little bit, or maybe not even give up, but you just like you can't affect it as a singular sort of unit. Or just as a single journalist, and I don't know.
Yeah, and it's so increasingly commercialized as well. You need to survive somehow,
right?
And you know, it follows market rules. If you can't deliver fast enough, if everyone else delivers instantaneously, no one will. Business won't ask what is the information value. Sadly, it should. Great business should, you know, should correlate with great journalism. But sadly, it seems like it's getting harder and harder.
Yeah, definitely. You know, business models are changing and things like that. At Wired, actually, we made a decision with our online, with our digital publication, not to try and cover news the fastest. You know, we kind of recognize we don't have the resources to do that. There are other outlets that are always going to be faster and kind of put something up quicker. So we tend to take a slower approach, and we'd rather be a little bit late to a story, but add something truly original, do the proper reporting, add that important context for our readers, and produce something with more analysis and more weight, rather than try to rush and put something up immediately. And I think that's worked really well for us. Our readers respond really well to
it. We actually talked about that before you came on to the podcast.
Great.
That we both love Wired, and just because of the fact that it is, in a sense, slow journalism, more deliberate, there's more analysis, and you can really get into the topics.
Yeah, actually investigative.
Yeah.
I'm glad that people notice that.
Yeah. But it seems also that there is, at least in our little bubble, there is this reaction also with people listening to podcasts, which kind of is the same thing, where you dive into topics much deeper, and people read quality journalism and try to boycott this, you know, garbage media, if you can say that. And there seems to be like some form of reaction forming, which is pretty good, I think.
In a way, it seems like a myth, this short attention span narrative. Whereas I think there's, as much as that exists, there's as much of a sort of counter reaction where people realize, like, no, we don't want these 10-minute inserts, and we don't want these sort of sound bites, and then people are actually looking for sort of real investigative media these days, more and more. And are you noticing this? I mean, you're a journalist, like people probably talk to you about this a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I notice this in sort of people's interaction with social media and things as well. I think, you know, there's been a real trend in recent years where people are trying to sort of take more control over how they use not just social media even, but like technology in general, you know, not having their notifications on all the time or checking their email less often in the day. There seems to have been a real sort of shift towards a, not necessarily a slower approach to life, but just feeling like you are using these devices, they are not using you, which is really interesting. I don't think that technology is bad. I don't think social media is bad. I'm not one of those people who thinks like that. But I do think it's probably a positive thing that people are thinking critically about how they can get the most out of technology for them.
Do you, the theme of slush this year, and it's been a theme in just, I guess, capitalism recently, where this sort of narrative of growth being questioned as the only sort of driving force, and today, you know, like the stage next to us, like they're having conversation on the stage of different people, and the themes they sort of juxtaposed business, technology, and startups with the needs of society, and obviously those two work together, but there is a bit of a tension between these two forces, and we notice this through climate change and many other sort of social issues. But how do you notice when talking to people who I mean, people in startups, people in technology, the tech field, how do you see people integrating these two spheres, and how are the values changing, basically?
So people trying to create a successful business, but also trying to do things
good,
better for the environment, or do things good for the world. Yeah, you know, I think it's a slow shift. As you say, like the power of capitalism is always very strong. But I think there's definitely, I mean, even just on the surface level, companies obviously are now recognizing that they need to be talking about these things. They need to be making commitments about things like sustainability, diversity, you know, whatever it might be. Sometimes that might just be, you know, talking the talk. But I think a lot of people are trying to sort of make meaningful changes, even if they start off small. I think I have spoken to, you know, some investors and things who now take sustainability into account when they're making investments, which I think is a really positive move, because I think, you know, if you kind of try and combine funding with that commitment to sustainability, that's one way to kind of make sure that it happens and to offer the incentives. I was speaking actually yesterday at Slush to some startups that are trying to work in the sustainability space, and they, you know, they said it is a challenge to try and find a business model that works for that, but that the discussions are at least sort of being had now. So yeah, I mean, I hope that trend kind of continues further, and I think there's a lot more pressure on companies now to really walk the walk And you know, even if they're only doing it to avoid a PR disaster, at least they're doing it. So yeah, there's a long way to go for sure. But fingers crossed.
Yeah, absolutely. And it seems like the more, as you said, the more money starts pouring into these kinds of efforts, the quicker we're gonna actually solve the real problems. But because I personally at least don't believe in you know, us being able on a governmental level or globally to solve, for instance, climate change. It seems very unlikely that we'll agree. Because we have so hard to, we have a hard time agreeing on just about anything at the moment. So we just need, I think we need good businesses that are universal, have a solution, and if someone is willing to pay a bit of money for that, which they surely are, then it just seems very logical that the problems will start going away, hopefully.
Hope so, because there are problems. Yeah. So, yeah.
If you look at the past, maybe the big three revolutions that have happened, like in recent years, that have changed the way we live. So you have the internet, and then you have the computer, and then you have the smartphone. And it's predicted that there will be similar ones in the coming 10, 20 years, and a lot more than three. Which ones do you think? And it's not easier, but which ones do you think will thoroughly change the world the most? Which technologies in the coming years?
I mean, I think AI definitely. Obviously, AI can stand for so many different things, and it can be applied in so many different ways. But when you're talking of a real sort of step change in the way things work on the scale of sort of the internet, that has to be the one. You know, for positives and negatives. And I think we're still in quite early stages of seeing that get into our hands and really affect our lives on a meaningful level. But yeah, so that would be the one I would select.
Yeah, that we can't let you off the hook that easily. So we have to. Is there one more? What is kind of a something? Do you have a theory on something that's not that obvious yet, but that might change the way we work and live?
Wow.
Even more thoroughly or at least on the same scale?
It's difficult to choose a single technology. I would say, because in a way I think almost social and cultural shifts might have a bigger impact on the way we live in the future than a specific technology. Obviously those can be aided and also caused by technological changes, but things like, city planning, whether that's affected by electric cars or ride sharing and that kind of thing, which again could have a very positive impact on the environment. You know, whether it's more people living in cities so that you end up with mega cities. I think, yeah, I'm answering this in a very rambling, roundabout way.
So were our questions. Fair enough. Yeah.
But yeah, I think those sort of social lifts, the social shifts in the way we live every day could shape the future more than necessarily a single kind of technological.
Isn't that kind of the point these days? Because we are tackling such new issues all the time that like any answer is bound to be like not just this podcast or like these questions, but like any sort of start of a dialogue is going to be a little bit rambling, a little bit vague. But it's just like we talk about like in our podcast, we were talking about the post by Financial Times where they basically came out and said like we need to fix this system. Like that we have fundamental problems in our listen market economy and we don't know how, but we just have to do something. And sort of we have to I feel like assume a different attitude towards the public dialogue in a way where we have to just realize that we need new ideas and we don't have a rule book yet. We don't have a guidebook, and it's kind of this generation that has a big load on it. It's like some people say that this generation is narcissistic. Yeah, but it's true that our generation has a big load on our shoulders to sort of figure out how to organize society again with these all new technologies that no one's seen before.
And the younger generation, you know, Gen Z, you see things like the school strikes with Greta Thunberg, against climate. This is, you know, a generation that's growing up very socially engaged, very politically engaged. And of course, with all the technologies that they take for granted, which we might still think are quite new. I think, I have a lot of hope for young people. I think you know, there's so many super smart young people out there. And I do think they, you know, both millennials and Gen Z can get a bad reputation, but actually everything whenever I see the things that they're doing, I'm hugely impressed.
I agree. And do you think it's going to be like a new 60s generation, in the sense where like this overturning of the previous paradigm? You kind of see this already with a lot of stuff like Me Too and now Greta Thunberg, as you mentioned. Do you feel this sort of stuff happen? I think it's more of a vibe than something you can actually look at empirically, but what do you feel like?
Wow.
Big question.
Yeah,
again.
You guys have the tough questions, don't you? Who knows?
You're pretty young too, so like you're in this.
Yeah.
Like we are, right?
I'm a millennial,
your words.
Yeah. You know, it so much depends on kind of externalities, you know, politics, things like that. But yeah, I mean, culturally, sure. Yeah, I think you're right. There's definitely kind of a sense of change in the air, and a sense of holding people to account and questioning sort of social norms and the way things are done. And maybe, you know, just because things have always been done a certain way doesn't necessarily mean they should continue so. And, you know, challenging those social structures that have let those things happen, whether it's Me Too or, you know, climate change, the climate crisis. And I think, you know, it's high time.
I agree. Yeah.
Maybe to round off with a more simple question, are you more excited or more afraid of the future, and maybe say it for the next 10 years or so?
Oh, wow. I'm excited. You know, at Wired, obviously, we are optimists about technology. We see the potential in technology and in science, scientific discoveries. And, you know, there's huge, great potential there, as long as we use it the right way. And I hope we will. I'm a positive person, so I'm going to stay excited. Obviously, there's going to be challenges. There's always going to be kind of difficulties that we face. But again, I think those always are more, you know, more social than anything else.
Great.
Thanks for joining our podcast. This was a pleasure.
Thanks for having me. Yeah. Thanks for the difficult questions.
Intense questions, yeah. But thank you so much.
Thank you. Great answers.
That's
fun.
Don't knock yourself, because it was great.
It was great.
Amazing. Thank you. Victoria. Victoria Turk from The Wired. Go read The Wired. Like, if you already haven't, probably a lot of you have already, but please do it.
I'd read it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed your visit to that conversation as much as we did. Now, if you want to stay updated and keep in touch with us, please subscribe to us on YouTube, follow us on Spotify, subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and all other podcast platforms. We're also on Twitter, Instagram, and then Facebook. You guessed it, Soaked by Slush. Thank you, people, for listening. Bye-bye.